arrived on a flatbed wagon, carrying his familiar long rifle. An old muzzle loader, I realized. With him in the wagon was Nigel and a tall, stocky black man. Tom Whalen was tall himself, but too lean to be as impressive as his massive slave. Whalen didn't look especially vicious or depraved. Right now, he only looked annoyed. We stood up as he climbed down from the wagon and came to face us.
"What happened here?" he asked suspiciously.
"The boy has a broken leg," said Kevin. "Are you his father?"
"Yes. Who are you?"
"My name's Kevin Franklin." He glanced at me but caught himself and didn't introduce me. "We came across the two boys right after the accident happened, and I thought we should stay with your son until you came for him." Whalen grunted and knelt to look at Rufus's leg.
"Guess it's broken, all right. Wonder how much that'll cost me."
The black man gave him a look of disgust that would surely have angered him if he had seen it.
"What were you doing climbing a damn tree?" Whalen demanded of Rufus.
Rufus stared at him silently. Whalen muttered something I didn't quite catch. He stood up and gestured sharply to the black man. The man came forward, lifted Rufus gently, and placed him on the wagon. Rufus's face twisted in pain as he was lifted, and he cried out as he was lowered into the wagon. Kevin and I should have made a splint for that leg, I thought belatedly. I followed the black man to the wagon. Rufus grabbed my arm and held it, obviously trying not to cry. His voice was a husky whisper.
"Don't go, Dana."
I didn't want to go. I liked the boy, and from what I'd heard of early 19th century medicine, they were going to pour some whiskey down him and play tug of war with his leg, and he was going to learn brand new things about pain. If I could give him any comfort by staying with him, I wanted to stay. But I couldn't. His father had spoken a few private words with Kevin and was now climbing back onto the seat of the wagon. He was ready to leave, and Kevin and I weren't invited. That didn't say much for Whalen's hospitality. People in his time of widely scattered plantations and even more widely scattered hotels had a reputation for taking in strangers. But then a man who could look at his injured son and think of nothing but how much the doctor bill would be wasn't likely to be concerned about strangers.
"Come with us," pleaded Rufus. "Daddy, let them come."
Whalen glanced back, annoyed, and I tried gently to loosen Rufus's grip on me. After a moment, I realized that Whalen was looking at me, staring hard at me. Perhaps he was seeing my resemblance to Alice's mother. He couldn't have seen me clearly enough or long enough at the river to recognize me now as the woman he had once come so near shooting. At first I stared back. Then I looked away, remembering that I was supposed to be a slave. Slaves lowered their eyes respectfully. To stare back was insolent, or at least that was what my book said.
"Come along and have dinner with us," Whalen told Kevin. "You may as well. Where were you going to stay the night anyway?"
"Under the trees, if necessary," said Kevin. He and I climbed onto the wagon beside the silent Nigel. "Not much choice, as I told you." I looked at him, wondering what he had told Whalen. Then I had to catch myself as the black man prodded the horses forward.
"You, girl," Whalen said to me. "What's your name?"
"Dana, sir." He turned to stare at me again, this time as though I'd said something wrong.
"Where do you come from?"
I glanced at Kevin, not wanting to contradict anything he had said. He gave me a slight nod, and I assumed I was free to make up my own lies. "I'm from New York." Now the look he was giving me was really ugly, and I wondered whether he'd heard a New York accent recently and found mine a poor match. Or was I saying something wrong? I hadn't said 10 words to him. What could be wrong? Whalen looked sharply at Kevin, then turned around and ignored us for the rest of the trip. We went through the woods to a road and along the road past a field of tall golden wheat. In the field, slaves, mostly men, worked steadily swinging scythes with attached wooden racks that caught the cut wheat in neat piles. Other slaves, mostly women, followed them, tying the wheat into bundles. None of them seemed to pay any attention to us. I looked around for a white overseer and was surprised not to see one. The Whalen house surprised me, too, when I saw it in daylight. It wasn't white. It had no columns, no porch to speak of. I was almost disappointed. It was a red-brick Georgian colonial, boxy but handsome in a quiet kind of way, 2.5 stories high, with dormered windows and a chimney on each end. It wasn't big or imposing enough to be called a mansion. In Los Angeles, in our time, Kevin and I could have afforded it. As the wagon took us up to the front steps, I could see the river off to one side and some of the land I had run through a few years before. Scattered trees, unevenly cut grass, the row of cabins far off to one side, almost hidden by the trees, the fields, the woods. There were other buildings lined up beside and behind the house opposite the slave cabins. As we stopped, I was almost sent off to one of these.
"Luke," said Whalen to the black man, "take Dinah around the back and get us something to eat."
"Yes, sir," said the black man softly. "Want me to take Ma's roof upstairs first?"
"Do what I told you. I'll take him up."
I saw Rufus set his teeth.
"I'll see you later," I whispered, but he wouldn't let go of my hand until I spoke to his father.
"Mr. Whalen, I don't mind staying with him. He seems to want me to." Whalen looked exasperated.
"Well, come on, then. You can wait with him until the doctor comes."
He lifted Rufus with no particular care and strode up the steps to the house. Kevin followed him.
"You watch out,"
said the black man softly as I started after them. I looked at him, surprised, not sure he was talking to me.
He was.
"Moss Tom can turn mean pretty quick," he said. "So can the boy, now that he's growing up. Your face looks like maybe you had enough white folks' meanness for a while."
I nodded. "I have, all right. Thanks for the warning." Nigel had come to stand next to the man, and I realized as I spoke that the two looked much alike, the boy a smaller replica of the man. Father and son, probably. They resembled each other more than Rufus and Tom Whalen did. As I hurried up the steps and into the house, I thought of Rufus and his father, of Rufus becoming his father. It would happen someday in at least one way. Someday Rufus would own the plantation. Someday he would be the slaveholder responsible in his own right for what happened to the people who lived in those half-hidden cabins. The boy was literally growing up as I watched. Growing up because I watched and because I helped to keep him safe. I was the worst possible guardian for him. A black to watch over him in a society that considered blacks subhuman. A woman to watch over him in a society that considered women perennial children. I would have all I could do to look after myself. But I would help him as best I could. And I would try to keep friendship with him. Maybe plant a few ideas in his mind that would help both me and the people who would be his slaves in the years to come. I might even be making those things easier for Alice. Now, I followed Whalen up the stairs to a bedroom, not the same one Rufus had occupied on my last trip. The bed was bigger, its full canopy and draperies blue instead of green. The room itself was bigger. Whalen dumped Rufus onto the bed, ignoring the boy's cries of pain. It did not look as though Whalen was trying to hurt Rufus. He just didn't seem to pay any attention to how he handled the boy, as though he didn't care. Then as Whalen was leading Kevin out of the room, a red-haired woman hurried in.
"Where is he?" she demanded breathlessly. "What happened?"
Rufus's mother. I remembered her. She pushed her way into the room just as I was putting Rufus's pillow under his head.
"What are you doing to him?" she cried. "Leave him alone!"
She tried to pull me away from her son. She had only one reaction when Rufus was in trouble. One wrong reaction. Fortunately for both of us, Waylon reached her before I forgot myself and pushed her away from me. He caught her, held her, spoke to her quietly.
Margaret, now listen. The boy has a broken leg, that's all. There's nothing you can do for a broken leg. I've already sent for the doctor.
Margaret Waylon seemed to calm down a little. She stared at me.
What's she doing here?
She belongs to Mr. Kevin Franklin here. Waylon waved a hand, presenting Kevin, who, to my surprise, bowed slightly to the woman.
Mr. Franklin is the one who found Rufus hurt, Waylon continued.
He shrugged.
Rufus wanted the girl to stay with him. Can't do any harm.
He turned and walked away. Kevin followed him reluctantly. The woman may have been listening as her husband spoke, but she didn't look as though she was. She was still staring at me, frowning at me as though she was trying to remember where she'd seen me before. The years hadn't changed her much, and of course they hadn't changed me at all. But I didn't expect her to remember. Her glimpse of me had been too brief, and her mind had been on other things.
I've seen you before, she said.
Hell.
Yes, ma'am, you may have.
I looked at Rufus and saw that he was watching us.
Mom, he said softly.
The accusing stare vanished, and the woman turned quickly to attend him.
My poor baby, she murmured,
cradling his head in her hands.
Seems like everything happens to you, doesn't it? A broken leg.
She looked close to tears, and there was Rufus swung from his father's indifference to his mother's sugary concern. I wondered whether he was too used to the contrast to find it dizzying.
Mom, can I have some water?
He asked. The woman turned to look at me as though I had offended her.
Can't you hear? Get him some water.
Yes, ma'am. Where shall I get it? She made a sound of disgust and rushed toward me. When I jumped out of her way, she kept right on going through the door that I had been standing in front of. I looked after her and shook my head. Then I took the chair that was near the fireplace and put it beside Rufus's bed. I sat down, and Rufus looked up at me solemnly.
Did you ever break your leg?
He asked. No. I broke my wrist once, though.
When they fixed it, did it hurt much?
I drew a deep breath.
Yes. I'm scared.
So was I said, remembering. But, Ruth, it won't take long, and when the doctor is finished, the worst'll be over.
Won't it still hurt after?
For a while, but it will heal. If you stay off it and give it a chance, it will heal. Margaret Waylon rushed back into the room with water for Rufus and more hostility for me than I could see any reason for.
You're to go out to the cookhouse and get some supper, she told me as I got out of her way.
But she made it sound as though she were saying, you're to go straight to hell. There was something about me that these people didn't like, except for Rufus. It wasn't just racial. They were used to black people. Maybe I could get Kevin to find out what it was.
Mama, can't she stay? Asked Rufus.
The woman threw me a dirty look, then turned gentler eyes on her son.
She can come back later, she told him. Your father wants her downstairs now.
More likely it was his mother who wanted me downstairs now, and possibly for no more substantial reason than that her son liked me. She gave me another look, and I left the room. The woman would have made me uncomfortable even if she'd liked me. She was too much nervous energy compacted into too small a container. I didn't want to be around when she exploded. But at least she loved Rufus, and he must have been used to her fussing over him. He hadn't seemed to mind. I found myself in a wide hallway. I could see the stairs a few feet away, and I started toward them. Just then a young black girl in a long blue dress came out of a door at the other end of the hall. She came toward me. staring at me with open curiosity. She wore a blue scarf on her head, and she tugged at it as she came toward me.
"Could you tell me where the cookhouse is, please?"
I said when she was near enough.
She seemed a safer person to ask than Margaret Whalen.
Her eyes opened a little wider, and she continued to stare at me. No doubt I sounded as strange to her as I looked.
"The cookhouse?" I said.
She looked me over once more, then started down the stairs without a word. I hesitated, finally followed her because I didn't know what else to do. She was a light-skinned girl, no older than 14 or 15. She kept looking back at me, frowning. Once she stopped and turned to face me, her hand tugging absently at her scarf, then moving lower to cover her mouth, and finally dropping to her side again. She looked so frustrated that I realized something was wrong.
"Can you talk?"
I asked. She sighed, shook her head.
"But you can hear and understand."
She nodded, then plucked at my blouse, at my pants. She frowned at me.
Was that the problem, then?
"They're the only clothes I have right now," I said. "My master will buy me some better ones sooner or later." Let it be Kevin's fault that I was dressed like a man. It was probably easier for the people here to understand a master too poor or too stingy to buy me proper clothing than it would be for them to imagine a place where it was normal for women to wear pants. As though to assure me that I had said the right thing, the girl gave me a look of pity, then took my hand and led me to the cookhouse. As we went, I took more notice of the house than I had before. More notice of the downstairs hall, anyway. Its walls were a pale green, and it ran the length of the house. At the front, it was wide and bright with light from the windows beside and above the door. It was strewn with oriental rugs of different sizes. Near the front door, there was a wooden bench, a chair, and two small tables. Past the stairs, the hall narrowed, and at its end, there was a back door that we went through. Outside was the cookhouse, a little white frame cottage not far behind the main house. I had read about outdoor kitchens and outdoor toilets. I hadn't been looking forward to either. Now, though, the cookhouse looked like the friendliest place I'd seen since I arrived. Luke and Nigel were inside eating from wooden bowls with what looked like wooden spoons, and there were two younger children, a girl and a boy, sitting on the floor eating with their fingers. I was glad to see them there, because I'd read about kids their age being rounded up and fed from troughs like pigs. Not everywhere, apparently. At least not here. There was a stocky middle-aged woman stirring a kettle that hung over the fire in the fireplace. The fireplace itself filled one whole wall. It was made of brick, and above it was a huge plank from which hung a few utensils. There were more utensils off to one side hanging from hooks on the wall. I stared at them and realized that I didn't know the proper names of any of them. Even things as commonplace as that. I was in a different world. The cook finished stirring her kettle and turned to look at me. She was as light-skinned as my mute guide, a handsome, middle-aged woman, tall and heavy-set. Her expression was grim, her mouth turned down at the corners, but her voice was soft and low.
"Carrie," she said. "Who's this?"
My guide looked at me. "My name is Dana," I said. "My master's visiting here. Mrs. Whalen told me to come out for supper."
"Mrs. Whalen?"
The woman frowned at me. "The red-haired woman, Rufus's mother?" I didn't quite catch myself in time to say Mr. Rufus. I didn't really see why I should have to say anything. How many Mrs. Whalens were there on the place anyway?
"Miss Margaret," said the woman, and under her breath, "bitch."
I stared at her in surprise, thinking she meant me.
"Sarah?"
Luke's tone was cautioning. He couldn't have heard what the cook said from where he was. Either she said it often, or he had read her lips. But at least now I understood that it was Mrs. Whalen, Miss Margaret, who was supposed to be the bitch.
The cook said nothing else. She got me a wooden bowl, filled it with something from a pot near the fire, and handed it to me with a wooden spoon. Supper was cornmeal mush. The cook saw that I was looking at it instead of eating it, and she misread my expression.
"That's not enough?" she asked.
"Oh, it's plenty." I held my bowl protectively, fearful that she might give me more of the stuff. "Thank you." I sat down at the end of a large, heavy table across from Nigel and Luke. I saw that they were eating the same mush, though theirs had milk on it. I considered asking for milk on mine, but I didn't really think it would help. Whatever was in the kettle smelled good enough to remind me that I hadn't had breakfast, hadn't had more than a few bites of dinner the night before. I was starving, and Sarah was cooking meat, probably a stew. I took a bite of the mush and swallowed it without tasting it.
"We get better food later on after the white folks eat," said Luke. "We get whatever they leave."
Table scraps, I thought bitterly. Someone else's leftovers. And no doubt, if I was here long enough, I would eat them and be glad to get them. They had to be better than boiled meal. I spooned the mush into my mouth, quickly fanning away several large flies. Flies. This was an era of rampant disease. I wondered how clean our leftovers would be by the time they reached us.
"Say you was from New York?" asked Luke.
"Yes."
"Free state?"
"Yes," I replied. "That's why I was brought here." The words, the questions, made me think of Alice and her mother. I looked at Luke's broad face, wondering whether it would do any harm to ask about them. But how could I admit to knowing them years ago, when I was supposed to be new here? Nigel knew I had been here before, but Sarah and Luke might not. It would be safer to wait, save my questions for Rufus.
"People in New York talk like you?" asked Nigel.
"Some do, not all."
"Dress like you?" asked Luke.
"No, I dress in what Master Kevin gives me to dress in." I wish they'd stop asking questions. I didn't want them to make me tell lies I might forget later. Best to keep my background as simple as possible. The cook came over and looked at me, at my pants. She pinched up a little of the material, feeling it.
"What cloth is this?"
she asked. "Polyester double knit," I thought. But I shrugged. "I don't know." She shook her head and went back to her pot. "You know," I said to her back, "I think I agree with you about Miss Margaret." She said nothing. The warmth I'd felt when I came into the room was turning out to be nothing more than the heat of the fire.
"Why you try to talk like white folks?" Nigel asked me.
"I don't," I said, surprised. "I mean, this is really the way I talk."
"More like white folks than some white folks."
I shrugged, hunted through my mind for an acceptable explanation. "My mother taught school," I said, "and..."
"A nigger teacher?"
I winced, nodded. "Free blacks can have schools. My mother talked the way I do. She taught me."
"You'll get into trouble," he said. "Marse Tom already don't like you. You talk too educated, and you come from a free state."
Why should either of those things matter to him? I don't belong to him. The boy smiled.
"He don't want no niggers round here talking better than him, putting freedom ideas in our heads."
"Like we so dumb we need some stranger to make us think about freedom," muttered Luke.
I nodded, but I hoped they were wrong. I didn't think I had said enough to Waylon for him to make that kind of judgment. I hoped he wasn't going to make that kind of judgment. I wasn't good at accents. I had deliberately decided not to try to assume one. But if that meant I was going to be in trouble every time I opened my mouth, my life here would be even worse than I had imagined.
"How can Mars Roof see you before you get here?" Nigel asked.
I choked down a swallow of mush.
"I don't know," I said.
but I wish to heaven he couldn't. 4. I stayed in the cookhouse when I finished eating because it was near the main house, and because I thought I could make it from the cookhouse into the hall if I started to feel dizzy, just in case. Wherever Kevin was in the house, he would hear me if I called from the hallway. Luke and Nigel finished their meal and went to the fireplace to say something privately to Sarah. At that moment, Carrie, the mute, slipped me bread and a chunk of ham. I looked at it, then smiled at her gratefully. When Luke and Nigel took Sarah out of the room with them, I feasted on a shapeless sandwich. In the middle of it, I caught myself wondering about the ham, wondering how well it had been cooked. I tried to think of something else, but my mind was full of vaguely remembered horror stories of the diseases that ran wild during this time. Medicine was just a little better than witchcraft. Malaria came from bad air. Surgery was performed on struggling, wide-awake patients. Germs were question marks even in the minds of many doctors. And people casually, unknowingly ingested all kinds of poorly preserved, ill-cooked food that could make them sick or kill them. Horror stories. Except that they were true and I was going to have to live with them for as long as I was here. Maybe I shouldn't have eaten the ham, but if I hadn't, it would be the table leavings later. I would have to take some chances. Sarah came back with Nigel and gave him a pot of peas to shell. Life went on around me as though I wasn't there. People came into the cookhouse, always black people, talked to Sarah, lounged around, ate whatever they could put their hands on until Sarah shouted at them and chased them away. I was in the middle of asking her whether there was anything I could do to help out when Rufus began to scream. 19th century medicine was apparently at work. The walls of the main house were thick, and the sound seemed to come from a long way off. Thin, high-pitched screaming. Carrie, who had left the cookhouse, now ran back in and sat down beside me with her hands covering her ears. Abruptly, the screaming stopped, and I moved Carrie's hands gently. Her sensitivity surprised me. I would have thought she would be used to hearing people scream in pain. She listened for a moment, heard nothing, then looked at me. "He probably fainted," I said. "That's best. He won't feel the pain for a while." She nodded dully and went back out to whatever she had been doing. "She always did like him," remarked Sarah into the silence. "He kept the children from bothering her when she was little." I was surprised. "Isn't she a few years older than he is?" "Born the year before him. Children listen to him, though. He's white."
"Is Carrie your daughter?"
Sarah nodded. "My fourth baby. The only one Mars Tom let me keep." Her voice trailed away to a whisper.
"You mean he sold the others?"
"Sold them. First my man died. A tree he was cutting fell on him. Then Mars Tom took my children, all but Carrie. And bless God, Carrie ain't worth much as the others 'cause she can't talk. People think she ain't got good sense."
I looked away from her. The expression in her eyes had gone from sadness, she seemed almost ready to cry, to anger. Quiet, almost frightening anger. Her husband dead, three children sold, the fourth defective, and her having to thank God for the defect. She had reason for more than anger. How amazing that Waylon had sold her children and still kept her to cook his meals. How amazing that he was still alive. I didn't think he would be for long, though, if he found a buyer for Carrie. As I was thinking, Sarah turned and threw a handful of something into the stew or soup she was cooking. I shook my head. If she ever decided to take her revenge, Waylon would never know what hit him.
"You can peel these potatoes for me," she said.
I had to think a moment to remember that I had offered my help. I took the large pan of potatoes that she was handing me, and a knife, and a wooden bowl, and I work silently, sometimes peeling and sometimes driving away the bothersome flies. Then I heard Kevin outside calling me. I had to make myself put the potatoes down calmly and cover them with a cloth Sarah had left on the table. Then I went to him without haste, without any sign of the eagerness or relief I felt at having him nearby again. I went to him, and he looked at me strangely.
"Are you all right?"
"Fine now." He reached for my hand, but I drew back, looking at him. He dropped his hand to his side.
"Come on," he said wearily. "Let's go where we can talk."
He led the way past the main house, away from the slave cabins and other buildings, away from the small slave children who chased each other and shouted and didn't understand yet that they were slaves. We found a huge oak with branches thick as separate trees spread wide to shade a large area, a handsome, lonely old tree. We sat beside it, putting it between ourselves and the house. I settled close to Kevin, relaxing, letting go of tension I had hardly been aware of. We said nothing for a while, as he leaned back and seemed to let go of tensions of his own. Finally, he said,
"There are so many really fascinating times we could have gone back to visit."
I laughed without humor. "I can't think of any time I'd like to go back to. But of all of them, this must be one of the most dangerous for me, anyway."
"Not while I'm with you."
I glanced at him gratefully.
"Why did you try to stop me from coming?"
"I was afraid for you."
"For me?"
"Well, at first I didn't know why. I just had the feeling you might be hurt trying to come with me. Then when you were here, I realized that you probably couldn't get back without me. That means if we're separated, you're stranded here for years, maybe for good."
He drew a deep breath and shook his head.
"There wouldn't be anything good about that."
"Stay close to me. If I call, come quick."
He nodded, and after a while said,
"I could survive here, though, if I had to. I mean, if..."
"Kevin, no ifs, please."
"I only mean I wouldn't be in the danger you would be in."
"No." "But he'd be in another kind of danger. A place like this would endanger him in a way I didn't want to talk to him about. If he was stranded here for years, some part of this place would rub off on him. No large part, I knew, but if he survived here, it would be because he managed to tolerate the life here. He wouldn't have to take part in it, but he would have to keep quiet about it. Free speech and press hadn't done too well in the antebellum South. Kevin wouldn't do too well either. The place, the time, would either kill him outright or mark him somehow. I didn't like either possibility.
Dana?
I looked at him.
Don't worry. We arrive together, and we'll leave together.
I didn't stop worrying, but I smiled and changed the subject.
How's Rufus? I heard him screaming.
Poor kid. I was glad when he passed out. The doctor gave him some opium, but the pain seemed to reach him right through it. I had to help hold him.
Opium? Will he be all right?
The doctor thought so, although I don't know how much a doctor's opinion is worth in this time.
I hope he's right. I hope Rufus has used up all his bad luck just in getting the set of parents he's stuck with.
Kevin lifted one arm and turned it to show me a set of long, bloody scratches.
"Margaret Whalen," I said softly.
"She shouldn't have been there," he said. "When she finished with me, she started on the doctor. 'Stop hurting my baby.'"
I shook my head. "What are we going to do, Kevin? Even if these people were sane, we couldn't stay here among them."
"Yes, we can."
I turned to stare at him. I made up a story for Whalen to explain why we were here and why we were broke. He offered me a job.
"Doing what?"
"Tutoring your little friend. Seems he doesn't read or write any better than he climbs trees."
"But doesn't he go to school?"
"Not while that leg is healing. and his father doesn't want him to fall any farther behind than he already is.
Is he behind others his age?
Waylon seemed to think so. He didn't come right out and say it, but I think he's afraid the kid isn't very bright. I'm surprised he cares one way or the other, and I think he's wrong. But for once, Rufus's bad luck is our good luck. I doubt that we'll be here long enough for you to collect any of your salary, but at least while we're here, we'll have food and shelter. That's what I thought when I accepted.
And what about me?
You? Waylon didn't say anything about me?
No.
Why should he? If I stay here, he knows you stay too.
Yes, I smiled. You're right. If you didn't remember me in your bargaining, why should he?
I'll bet he won't forget me, though, when he has work that needs to be done.
Wait a minute. You don't have to work for him. You're not supposed to belong to him.
No, but I'm here, and I'm supposed to be a slave. What's a slave for but to work? Believe me, he'll find something for me to do. Or he would if I didn't plan to find my own work before he gets around to me.
He frowned.
You want to work?
I want to... I have to make a place for myself here. That means work. I think everyone here, black and white, will resent me if I don't work. And I need friends. I need all the friends I can make here, Kevin. You might not be with me when I come here again. If I come here again. And unless that kid gets a lot more careful, you will come here again.
I sighed. It looks that way.
I hate to think of your working for these people.
He shook his head. I hate to think of you playing the part of a slave at all.
We knew I'd have to do it.
He said nothing.
Call me away from them now and then, Kevin, just to remind them that whatever I am, they don't own me. Yet.
He shook his head again angrily, in what looked like a refusal, but I knew he'd do it.
"What lies did you tell Waylon about us?" I asked him.
"The way people ask questions around here, we'd better make sure we're both telling the same story."
For several seconds, he said nothing.
"Kevin?"
He took a deep breath.
"I'm supposed to be a writer from New York," he said finally. "God help us if we meet any New Yorkers. I'm traveling through the South doing research for a book. I have no money because I drank with the wrong people a few days ago and was robbed. All I have left is you. I bought you before I was robbed because you could read and write. I thought you could help me in my work as well as be of use otherwise."
Did he believe that?
It's possible that he did. He was already pretty sure you could read and write. That's one reason he seemed so suspicious and mistrustful. Educated slaves aren't popular around here.
I shrugged.
So Nigel has been telling me. Waylon doesn't like the way you talk. I don't think he's had much education himself, and he resents you. I don't think he'll bother you. I wouldn't stay here if I did. But keep out of his way as much as you can.
Gladly. I plan to fit myself into the cookhouse if I can. I'm going to tell Sarah you want me to learn how to cook for you.
He gave a short laugh. I'd better tell you the rest of the story I told Waylon. If Sarah hears it all, she might teach you how to put a little poison in my food.
I think I jumped.
Waylon was warning me that it was dangerous to keep a slave like you, educated, maybe kidnapped from a free state, as far north as this. He said I ought to sell you to some trader heading for Georgia or Louisiana before you ran away and I lost my investment. That gave me the idea to tell him I planned to sell you in Louisiana because that is where my journey ended, and I'd heard I could make a nice profit on you down there. That seemed to please him, and he told me I was right. Prices were better in Louisiana if I could hold on to you until I got you there. So I said, educated or not, you weren't likely to run away from me, because I'd promised to take you back to New York with me and set you free. I told him you didn't really want to leave me right now anyway. He got the idea.
You make yourself sound disgusting.
I know. I think I was trying to at the end, trying to see whether anything I did to you could make me someone he wouldn't want anywhere near his kid. I think he did cool a little toward me when I said I'd promised you freedom. but he didn't say anything.
What were you trying to do? Lose the job you'd just gotten?
No, but while I was talking to him, all I could think was that you might be coming back here alone someday. I kept trying to find the humanity in him to reassure myself that you would be all right.
Oh, he's human enough. If he were of a little higher social class, he might even have been disgusted enough with your bragging not to want you around.
But he wouldn't have had the right to stop you from betraying me. I'm your private property. He'd respect that.
You call that human?
I'm going to do all I can to see that you never come back here alone again.
I leaned back against the tree, watching him.
Just in case I do, Kevin, let's take out some insurance.
What?
Let me help you with Rufus as much as I can. Let's see what we can do to keep him from growing up into a red-haired version of his father.
5. But for 3 days I didn't see Rufus, nor did anything happen to bring on the dizziness that would tell me I was going home at last. I helped Sarah as well as I could. She seemed to warm up to me a little, and she was patient with my ignorance of cooking. She taught me and saw to it that I ate better. No more cornmeal mush once she realized I didn't like it.
"Why didn't you say something?"
she asked me. Under her direction, I spent God knows how long beating biscuit dough with a hatchet on a well-worn tree stump.
"Not so hard. You ain't driving nails. Regular, like this."
I cleaned and plucked a chicken, prepared vegetables, kneaded bread dough, and when Sarah was weary of me, helped Carrie and the other house servants with their work. I kept Kevin's room clean. I brought him hot water to wash and shave with, and I washed in his room. It was the only place I could go for privacy. I kept my canvas bag there, too, and went there to avoid Margaret Whalen when she came rubbing her fingers over dustless furniture and looking under rugs on well-swept floors. Differences be damned, I did know how to sweep and dust, no matter what century it was. Margaret Whalen complained because she couldn't find anything to complain about. That she made painfully clear to me the day she threw scalding hot coffee at me, screaming that I had brought it to her cold. So I hid from her in Kevin's room. It was my refuge, but it was not my sleeping place. I had been given sleeping space in the attic where most of the house servants slept. It apparently never occurred to anyone that I should sleep in Kevin's room. Whalen knew what kind of relationship Kevin was supposed to have with me, but our sleeping arrangement told us that he expected discretion, or we assumed it did. We cooperated for 3 days. On the fourth day, Kevin caught me on my way out to the cookhouse and took me to the oak tree again.
"Are you having trouble with Margaret Whalen?" he asked.
"Nothing I can't handle," I said, surprised.
"Why?"
"I heard a couple of the house servants talking, just saying vaguely that there was trouble. I thought I should find out for sure."
I shrugged, said, "I think she resents me because Rufus likes me. She probably doesn't want to share her son with anyone. Heaven help him when he gets a little older and tries to break away. Also, I don't think Margaret likes educated slaves any better than her husband does."
"I see. I was right about him, by the way. He can barely read and write, and she's not much better."
He turned to face me squarely. "Did she throw a pot of hot coffee on you?"
I looked away. "It doesn't matter. Most of it missed anyway."
"Why didn't you tell me? She could have hurt you."
"She didn't." "I don't think we should give her another chance." I looked at him. "What do you want to do?"
"Get out of here. We don't need money badly enough for you to put up with whatever she plans to do next."
"No, Kevin. I had a reason for not telling you about the coffee."
"I'm wondering what else you haven't told me."
"Nothing important."
My mind went back over some of Margaret's petty insults. "Nothing important enough to make me leave."
"But why? There's no reason for..."
"Yes, there is. I've thought about it, Kevin. It isn't the money that I care about, or even having a roof over my head. I think we can survive here together, no matter what. But I don't think I have much of a chance surviving here alone.
I've told you that. You won't be alone. I'll see to it. You'll try. Maybe that will be enough. I hope so. But if it isn't, if I do have to come here alone, I'll have a better chance of survival if I stay here now and work on the insurance we talked about. Rufus. He'll probably be old enough to have some authority when I come again. Old enough to help me. I want him to have as many good memories of me as I can give him now. He might not remember you past the day you leave here. He'll remember. It still might not work. After all, his environment will be influencing him every day you're gone. And from what I've heard, it's common in this time for the master's children to be on nearly equal terms with the slaves. But maturity is supposed to put both in their places. Sometimes it doesn't. Even here, not all the children let themselves be molded into what their parents want them to be. You're gambling. Hell, you're gambling against history. What else can I do? I've got to try, Kevin, and if trying means taking small risks and putting up with small humiliations now so that I can survive later, I'll do it. He drew a deep breath and let it out in a near whistle. Yeah, I guess I don't blame you. I don't like it, but I don't blame you. I put my head on his shoulder. I don't like it either. God, I hate it. That woman is priming herself for a nervous breakdown. I just hope she doesn't have it while I'm here. Kevin shifted his position a little and I sat up. Let's forget about Margaret for a moment, he said. I also wanted to talk to you about that place where you sleep. Oh. Yes. Oh. I finally got up to see it. A rag pallet on the floor, Dana. Did you see anything else up there? What? What else should I have seen? A lot of rag pallets on the floor, and a couple of corn shuck mattresses. I'm not being treated any worse than any other house servant, Kevin, and I'm doing better than the field hands. Their pallets are on the ground. Their cabins don't even have floors, and most of them are full of fleas. There was a long silence. Finally, he sighed. I can't do anything for the others, he said, but I want you out of that attic. I want you with me. I sat up and stared down at my hands. You don't know how I've wanted to be with you. I keep imagining myself waking up at home some morning, alone. Not likely. Not unless something threatens you or endangers you during the night. You don't know that for sure. Your theory could be wrong. Maybe there's some kind of limit on how long I can stay here. Maybe a bad dream would be enough to send me home. Maybe anything. Maybe I should test my theory. That stopped me. I realized he was talking about endangering me himself, or at least making me believe my life was in danger, scaring the hell out of me, scaring me home, maybe. I swallowed. That might be a good idea, but I don't think you should have mentioned it to me, warned me. Besides, I'm not sure you could scare me enough. I trust you. He covered one of my hands with his own. You can go on trusting me. I won't hurt you. But I don't have to hurt you. I can arrange something that will scare you before you have time to think about it. I can handle it. I accepted that. Began to think maybe he really could get us home. Kevin, wait until Rufus's leg is healed. So long? He protested. 6 weeks, maybe more. Hell, in a society as backwards as this, who knows whether the leg will heal at all? Whatever happens, the boy will live. He still has to father a child, and that means he'll probably have time to call me here again, with or without you. Give me the chance I need, Kevin, to reach him and make a haven for myself here. All right, he said, sighing. We'll wait a while, but you won't do your waiting in that attic. You're moving into my room tonight. I thought about that. All right. Getting you home with me when I go is the one thing more important to me than staying with Rufus.
It's worth getting kicked off the plantation for.
Don't worry about that. Waylon doesn't care what we do.
But Margaret will care. I've seen her using that limited reading ability of hers on her Bible. I suspect that in her own way, she's a fairly moral woman.
You want to know how moral she is?
His tone made me frown.
What do you mean?
If she chases me any harder, she and I will wind up playing a scene from that Bible she reads, the scene between Potiphar's wife and Joseph.
I swallowed. That woman. But I could see her in my mind's eye. Long, thick, red hair piled high on her head, fine, smooth skin. Whatever her emotional problems, she wasn't ugly.
I'm moving in tonight, all right, I said.
He smiled.
If we're quiet about it, they might not even bother to notice. Hell, I saw three little kids playing in the dirt back there who look more like Waylon than Rufus does. Margaret's had a lot of practice at not noticing.
I knew which children he meant. They had different mothers, but there was a definite family resemblance between them. I'd seen Margaret Waylon slap one of them hard across the face. The child had done nothing more than toddle into her path. If she was willing to punish a child for her husband's sins, would she be any less willing to punish me if she knew that I was where she wanted to be with Kevin? I tried not to think about it.
We still might have to leave, I said. No matter what these people have to accept from each other, they might not be willing to tolerate immorality from us.
He shrugged.
If we have to leave, we leave. There's a limit to what you should put up with, even to get your chance to be with the boy.
We'll work our way to Baltimore. I should be able to get some kind of job there.
If we go to a city, how about Philadelphia?
Philadelphia?
Because it's in Pennsylvania. If we leave here, let it be for a free state.
Oh, yes. I should have thought of that myself.
Look, Dana, we might have to go to one of the free states anyway.
He hesitated.
I mean, if it turns out we can't get home the way we think we can. I'll probably become an unnecessary expense to Waylon when Rufus's leg heals. Then we'd have to make a home for ourselves somewhere.
That probably won't happen, but it's a possibility.
I nodded. Now let's go get whatever belongs to you out of the attic.
He stood up.
And Dana? Rufus says his mother is going out visiting today. He'd like to see you while she's gone.
Why didn't you tell me sooner? A start, finally.
Later that day, as I was mixing some cornbread batter for Sarah, Carrie came to get me. She made a sign to Sarah that I had already learned to understand. She wiped the side of her face with one hand as though rubbing something off. Then she pointed to me.
Dana, said Sarah over her shoulder. One of the white folks wants you. Go with Carrie.
I went. Carrie led me up to Rufus's room, knocked, and left me there. I went in and found Rufus in bed with his leg sandwiched between the two boards of a wooden splint and held straight by a device of rope and cast iron. The iron weight looked like something borrowed from Sarah's kitchen, a heavy little hooked thing I'd once seen her hang meat on to roast. But it apparently served just as well to keep Rufus's leg in traction.
How are you feeling? I asked as I sat down in the chair beside his bed.
It doesn't hurt as much as it did, he said. I guess it's getting well. Kevin said, do you care if I call him Kevin?
No, I think he wants you to.
I have to call him Mr. Franklin when Mama is here. Anyway, he said you're working with Aunt Sarah.
Aunt Sarah. Well, that was better than Mammy Sarah, I suppose.
I'm learning her way of cooking. She's a good cook, but does she hit you?
Of course not, I laughed.
She had a girl in there a while back, and she used to hit her. The girl finally asked Daddy to let her go back to the fields. That was right after Daddy sold Aunt Sarah's boys, though. Aunt Sarah was mad at everybody then.
I don't blame her, I said. Rufus glanced at the door, then said low-voiced,
Neither do I. Her boy Jim was my friend. He taught me how to ride when I was little, but Daddy sold him anyway.
He glanced at the door again and changed the subject.
Dana, can you read?
Yes. Kevin said you could. I told Mama and she said you couldn't.
I shrugged. What do you think? He took a leather-bound book from under his pillow.
Kevin brought me this from downstairs. Would you read it to me?
I fell in love with Kevin all over again. Here was the perfect excuse for me to spend a lot of time with the boy. The book was Robinson Crusoe. I could remember not really liking it, but not quite being able to put it down. Crusoe had, after all, been on a slave trading voyage when he was shipwrecked. I opened the book with some apprehension, wondering what archaic spelling and punctuation I would face. I found the expected F's for S's and a few other things that didn't turn up as often, but I got used to them very quickly. And I began to get into Robinson Crusoe. As a kind of a castaway myself, I was happy to escape into the fictional world of someone else's trouble. I read and read and drank some of the water Rufus's mother had left for him, and read some more. Rufus seemed to enjoy it. I didn't stop until I thought he was falling asleep, but even then, as I put the book down, he opened his eyes and smiled.
Nigel said your mother was a school teacher.
She was.
I like the way you read. It's almost like being there watching everything happen.
Thank you.
There's a lot more books downstairs.
I've seen them. I had also wondered about them. The Whalens didn't seem to be the kind of people who would have a library.
They belong to Miss Hannah, explained Rufus obligingly. Daddy was married to her before he married Mama, but she died. This place used to be hers. He said she read so much that before he married Mama, he made sure she didn't like to read.
What about you? He moved uncomfortably.
Reading's too much trouble. Mr. Jennings said I was too stupid to learn anyway.
Who's Mr. Jennings?
He's the schoolmaster.
Is he? I shook my head in disgust. He shouldn't be. Listen, do you think you're stupid?
No.
A small, hesitant no.
But I read as good as Daddy does already. Why should I have to do any more than that?
You don't have to. You can stay just the way you are. Of course, that would give Mr. Jennings the satisfaction of thinking he was right about you. Do you like him?
Nobody likes him.
Don't be so eager to satisfy him, then. And what about the boys you go to school with? It is just boys, isn't it? No girls.
Yeah.
Well, look at the advantage they're going to have over you when you grow up. They'll know more than you. They'll be able to cheat you if they want to. Besides, I held up Robinson Crusoe. Look at the pleasure you'll miss. He grinned.
Not with you here. Read some more.
I don't think I'd better. It's getting late. Your mother will be home soon.
No, she won't. Read.
I sighed. Roof, your mother doesn't like me. I think you know that. He looked away.
We have a little more time, he said. Maybe you'd better not read, though. I forget to listen for her when you read.
I handed him the book. You read me a few lines. He accepted the book, looked at it as though it were his enemy. After a moment, he began to read haltingly. Some words stopped him entirely, and I had to help. After two painful paragraphs, he stopped and shut the book in disgust.
You can't even tell it's the same book when I read it, he said.
Let Kevin teach you, I said. He doesn't believe you're stupid, and neither do I. You'll learn all right, unless he really did have some kind of problem, poor vision or some learning disability that people in this time would see as stubbornness or stupidity.
Unless... What did I know about teaching children? All I could do was hope the boy had as much potential as I thought he did. I got up to go, then sat down again, remembering another unanswered question. Ruth, whatever happened to Alice? Nothing. He looked surprised. I mean, the last time I saw her, her father had just been beaten because he went to see her and her mother.
Oh, well, Daddy was afraid he'd run off, so he sold him to a trader.
Sold him? Does he still live around here?
No, the trader was headed south, to Georgia, I think.
Oh, God, I sighed. Are Alice and her mother still here?
Sure, I still see them when I can walk.
Did they have any trouble because I was with them that night? That was as near as I dared to come to asking what had happened to my would-be enslaver.
I don't think so. Alice said you came and went so quick.
I went home. I can't tell when I'm going to do that. It just happens.
Back to California?
Yes.
Alice didn't see you go. She said you just went into the woods and didn't come back.
That's good. Seeing me vanish would have frightened her. Alice was keeping her mouth closed too then, or her mother was. Alice might not know what happened. Clearly there were things that even a friendly young white could not be told. On the other hand, if the patroller himself hadn't spread the word about me or taken revenge on Alice and her mother, maybe he was dead. My blow could have killed him. Or someone could have finished him after I went home. If they had, I didn't want to know about it. I got up again. I have to go, Ruth. I'll see you again whenever I can.
Dinah?
I looked down at him.
I told Mama who you were. I mean that you were the one who saved me from the river. She said it wasn't true, but I think she really believed me. I told her because I thought it might make her like you better.
It hasn't, that I've noticed.
I know, he frowned. Why doesn't she like you? Did you do something to her?
Not likely. After all, what would happen to me if I did something to her?
Yeah, but why doesn't she like you?
You'll have to ask her.
She won't tell me.
He looked up solemnly.
I keep thinking you're going to go home, and somebody will come and tell me you and Kevin are gone. I don't want you to go, but I don't want you to get hurt here either.
I said nothing.
You be careful, he said softly.
I nodded and left the room. Just as I reached the stairs, Tom Whalen came out of his bedroom.
What are you doing up here?
He demanded. Visiting Mr. Rufus, I said. He asked to see me.
You were reading to him.
Now I knew how he happened to come out just in time to catch me. He had been eavesdropping. For God's sake, what had he expected to hear? Or rather, what had he heard that he shouldn't have? About Alice, perhaps? What would he make of that? For a moment, my mind raced, searching for excuses, explanations. Then I realized I wouldn't need them. I would have met him outside Rufus's door if he had stayed long enough to hear about Alice. He had probably heard me addressing Rufus a little too familiarly. Nothing worse. I had deliberately not said anything damaging about Margaret because I thought her own attitude would damage her more in her son's eyes than anything I could say. I made myself face Whalen calmly. Yes, I was reading to him, I admitted. He asked me to do that, too. I think he was bored lying in there with nothing to do.
I didn't ask you what you thought, he said.
I said nothing. He walked me farther from Rufus's door, then stopped and turned to look hard at me. His eyes went over me like a man sizing up a woman for sex, but I got no message of lust from him. His eyes, I noticed, not for the first time, were almost as pale as Kevin's. Rufus and his mother had bright green eyes. I liked the green better somehow.
How old are you? He asked.
26, sir.
You say that like you're sure.
Yes, sir, I am.
What year were you born?
1793. I had figured that out days ago, thinking that it wasn't a part of my personal history I should hesitate over if someone asked. At home, a person who hesitated over his birth date was probably about to lie. As I spoke, though, I realized that here, a person might hesitate over his birth date simply because he didn't know it. Sarah didn't know hers.
26, then, said Waylon. How many children have you had?
None. I kept my face impassive, but I couldn't keep myself from wondering where these questions were leading.
No children by now?
He frowned.
You must be barren, then.
I said nothing. I wasn't about to explain anything to him. My fertility was none of his business anyway. He stared at me a little longer, making me angry and uncomfortable, but I concealed my feelings as well as I could.
You like children, though, don't you?
He asked.
You like my boy?
Yes, sir, I do.
Can you cipher, too, along with your reading and writing?
Yes, sir.
How'd you like to be the one to do the teaching?
Me? I managed to frown, managed not to laugh aloud with relief. Tom Whalen wanted to buy me. In spite of all his warnings to Kevin of the dangers of owning educated, northern-born slaves, he wanted to buy me. I pretended not to understand. But that's Mr. Franklin's job.
Could be your job.
Could it?
I could buy you. Then you'd live here instead of traveling around the country without enough to eat or a place to sleep.
I lowered my eyes. That's for Mr. Franklin to say.
I know it is, but how do you feel about it?
Well, no offense, Mr. Whalen. I'm glad we stopped here. And as I said, I like your son, but I'd rather stay with Mr. Franklin. He gave me an unmistakable look of pity.
If you do, girl, you'll live to regret it.
He turned and walked away. I stared after him, believing in spite of myself that he really felt sorry for me. That night I told Kevin what had happened, and he wondered too. Be careful, Dana, he said unwittingly, echoing Rufus. Be as careful as you can. 6. I was careful. I played the slave, minded my manners probably more than I had to because I wasn't sure what I could get away with. Not much, as it turned out. Once I was called over to the slave cabins, the quarter, to watch Waylon punish a field hand for the crime of answering back. Waylon ordered the man stripped naked and tied to the trunk of a dead tree. As this was being done by other slaves, Waylon stood whirling his whip and biting his thin lips. Suddenly he brought the whip down across the slave's back. The slave's body jerked and strained against its ropes. I watched the whip for a moment, wondering whether it was like the one Waylon had used on Rufus years before. If it was, I understood completely why Margaret Waylon had taken the boy and fled. The whip was heavy and at least 6 feet long, and I wouldn't have used it on anything living. It drew blood and screams at every blow. I watched and listened and longed to be away. But Waylon was making an example of the man. He had ordered all of us to watch the beating, all the slaves. Kevin was in the main house somewhere, probably not even aware of what was happening. The whipping served its purpose as far as I was concerned. It scared me, made me wonder how long it would be before I made a mistake that would give someone reason to whip me. Or had I already made that mistake? I had moved into Kevin's room after all, and though it would be perceived as Kevin's doing, I could be made to suffer for it.
The fact that the Waylands didn't seem to notice my move gave me no real comfort. Their lives and mine were so separate that it might take them several days to realize that I had abandoned my place in the attic. I always got up before they did to get water and live coals from the cookhouse to start Kevin's fire. Matches had apparently not been invented yet. Neither Sarah nor Rufus had ever heard of them. By now, the manservant Waylon had assigned to Kevin ignored him completely, and Kevin and his room were left to me. It took us twice as long to get a fire started, and it took me longer to carry water up and down the stairs, but I didn't care. The jobs I had assigned myself gave me legitimate reason for going in and out of Kevin's room at all hours, and they kept me from being assigned more disagreeable work. Most important to me, though, they gave me a chance to preserve a little of 1976 amid the slaves and slaveholders. After washing and watching Kevin bloody his face with the straight razor he had borrowed from Waylon, I would go down to help Sarah with breakfast. Whole mornings went by without my seeing either of the Waylons. At night, I helped clean up after supper and prepare for the next day. So like Sarah and Carrie, I rose before the Waylons and went to bed after them. That gave me several days of peace before Margaret Waylon discovered that she had another reason to dislike me. She cornered me one day as I swept the library. If she had walked in 2 minutes earlier, she would have caught me reading a book. "Where did you sleep last night?" she demanded in a strident, accusing voice she reserved for slaves. I straightened to face her, rested my hands on the broom. How lovely it would have been to say, "None of your business, bitch." Instead, I spoke softly, respectfully. "In Mr. Franklin's room, ma'am." I didn't bother to lie because all the house servants knew. It might even have been one of them who alerted Margaret. So now what would happen? Margaret slapped me across the face. I stood very still, gazed down at her with frozen calm. She was 3 or 4 inches shorter than I was and proportionately smaller. Her slap hadn't hurt me much. It had simply made me want to hurt her. Only my memory of the whip kept me still. "You filthy black whore," she shouted. "This is a Christian house." I said nothing. "I'll see you sent to the quarter where you belong." Still, I said nothing. I looked at her.